It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. Feeling a little cooped up these days? Tired of living life online? Yeah, me too. In fact, you know what? Let's go for a walk. Because sometimes the most reliable place to find solace is in nature. I stay indoors for too long. Maybe that's like this for you. Somehow the whole world shrinks just to the size of my house. And the rest of the world starts to feel sort of fictional, like maybe it doesn't even really exist. It gets you out of yourself, coming out here. I think it's the sheer, overwhelming diversity of life. Gazillions of blades of grass and clover and dandelions, and think of the number of birds, the number of insects, the life lived in one tree. You know, we're not used to thinking of trees, let alone dandelions, as other beings. But there is that feeling that you're not alone when you're out here. Anyway, that's one reason I like coming out for a walk. A lot of us are trying to walk more right now, and you can have that experience of reconnecting with the natural world almost anywhere, even in one of the biggest cities in the world.
Oh, if I don't walk 800 miles a year, I'm not myself.
That's William Helmreich, the man famous for exploring every block of New York City on foot and writing about it. He died earlier this year of COVID-19. He was one of the first casualties of the virus. Our friend David Rothenberg has been thinking about him a lot. David is a musician and a philosopher who's recorded a series of New York sound walks, including one with William Helmreich.
William Helmreich I'd known about for years, and I really wanted to go on a walk with him, and immediately he said no.
You've got a lot to do here.
I'm too busy. I'm doing it all again. I wrote this book, The New York Nobody Knows, and now I'm doing it borough by borough. So we have the Brooklyn Nobody Knows, the Queens Nobody Knows. So it requires him to walk every single street again. And he said, I'm 72. I don't want to run out of time here. I got to work every single day on this.
Hey, you going to work?
Yes.
This way? What a nice walk to work.
Yeah,
here. That's exactly how I talk to people in the street. That's how I start a conversation.
Because I kept hassling him about it, and he finally agreed. And we had much more fun than I imagined we would.
My old man took me on trips to keep me interested when I was a little kid. Every Sunday, Saturday, he played a game called Last Stop. We'd get in the subway on 103rd Street, and we would take the train to the last stop, and from there, we would get out and walk for a couple of hours. My father gave me something far more precious than presents. He gave me the gift of time. And so I learned to love New York City from the ages of 7 through 12 because we played this game.
Okay. It's Joe Louis' house.
Nice. This should have a plaque.
Literally, we went from place to place to place. There were special things to see. And he was like also teaching me how to do it. How are you going to walk? How do you engage with people?
You try and talk to almost everybody.
Yeah, I
know. Because some people do this kind of work, they don't want to talk.
No, but my work is people. Without people, what's the city? I will find something to say to somebody. It doesn't matter what type of person they are. A member of the Bloods, an old lady. Because I look harmless. I'm too old to kill anybody, and I'm too old to be worth killing. Yeah, I was walking in the South Bronx, and suddenly, I know, like I said, I don't look for trouble. Suddenly there's some Bloods in red jackets. Mm. Black guys, you're looking at me. What the hell are you doing here? You come from hockey. So I made eye contact with him. I smiled. I said, hey, guys, I love those jackets. Where can I get one of those jackets? The guy looked at me and was stunned. I'm asking for a jacket. I should be slinking around.
Right.
He says, you want to get one of these jackets? He said, well, that would depend on who you is. I said, I ain't no Crip. I wasn't wearing blue.
Yeah.
I said, well, I ain't no Crip. He said, well, we'll take that under advisement. And he said, oh, good.
Right.
That was the end of that.
He was describing his days in the 60s writing a book about the Black Panthers. And he was saying they were always trying to kill him. Literally. Going to a meeting, someone put a gun at his head.
Yeah. And so a guy sticks a gun into my temple.
You're dead, honky motherfucker. You can leave that out. Beep.
And he cocks the trigger, and I figured, yes, I'm going to die. I got about 1 second.
And then someone, his friend would say, it's okay, man, he's with me. Oh, sorry. And, like, somebody, like, held him upside down out of a window. And he talked him out of it. And then the guy later apologized and said, like, yeah, I always hurt the things I love the most. I'm so sorry, Bill.
My life hung by a literal thread. Right.
My favorite part was this obscure park next to Kennedy Airport.
Oh, welcome to Audubon Preserve.
You have reached your destination.
Now, if you ever want to find a goddamn isolated place, this is it. And I figured a guy like you would appreciate this.
This is a park on the back side of Kennedy Airport that nobody goes to.
Yeah. Well, look at this. This is interesting.
What is that?
Just this large bird in that tree. Kind of big heron.
Cool.
Yeah, right. That's huge.
Fat bird.
Probably a great blue heron, but it's very grungy looking.
Look at that beak.
Yeah.
Sharp.
It just was a completely anomalous place. See, like, they're working on it. There were these guys fixing it, and they were shocked to see anyone there. They thought that we must be, you know, up to no good or kind of crazy or something. And then Bill's asking all these questions about it. And is this trail open? Is that one open? What are you doing here? And things like that.
We saw there were some developments there. Yeah,
yeah, there's this one that we just did, which it just kind of shows the freshwater wetland over here.
Oh, we want to see that. Where is that?
It's just past it. So the freshwater wetland.
You see this? If you want to stay healthy, what you got to do. You keep working. My father walked 5 miles a day into his 80s.
Yeah.
He always felt walking was the healthiest thing, and I believe that it very, is. Very strongly. Very, very strongly.
It's kind of probably a big
William Helmreich died earlier this year of COVID-19. He was a writer and sociologist famous for walking every street in New York, borough by borough, block by block. And that was David Rothenberg, the musician and eco-philosopher, with an excerpt from his Soundwalker podcast. Have you noticed that there's something about walking? It's just so calming. I think it's something about that bipedal movement and the fact that we're using both sides of our bodies. It's a rhythm that is so old as we are. I live in an ordinary city block, a bunch of houses, everybody's got lawns, the houses are really close together. And then I walk 5 minutes, and there's this lake. Every time I come down here, I just can't believe I live 5 minutes from this. See if we can hear the water. It's one of my favorite sounds in the world, the sound of water. I feel like it calls to something in our veins. What are we? 50, 60% water? I think our bodies recognize this. There's another thing I want to say about why I like coming out for a walk like this, partly just because I want to get away. I want to be alone. Somehow just being in one house with one husband 24/7 there are times when it kind of makes me want to scream. So that's another reason I go out for a walk. I think a lot of people have had that reaction to social distancing, and so maybe it's not surprising that there's a new interest in Henry David Thoreau, the hermit of Walden Pond. Thoreau was a complicated man. He was a recluse and also a social activist. Biographer Laura Dassow Walls told Steve Paulson that wasn't always easy.
How can he walk away from town, away from politics, away from the social storm that's breaking around them, to the pond, to nature? And it's a real question for him. He's not saying these two are compatible. I can do the one and I can do the other comfortably. He's challenging himself, saying, how dare I go out into nature when I need to be here on the front lines fighting against slavery. And he recovers himself to say that he does go out into nature and finds there a kind of symbolic, it's a white water lily, which for him is the Buddhist symbol of enlightenment.
And it's worth pointing out that he was fairly unusual in this regard. I mean, someone who really looked at these, drew inspiration and wisdom from these Eastern spiritual traditions, not just Christianity.
He saw Eastern spiritual traditions, Buddhism and Hinduism, most importantly to him, as living traditions, not faith traditions in the deep past or somewhere else. Well, this gets to transcendentalism.
Right. And I was going to ask about that. I mean, so he's associated with the transcendental movement, most famously associated with his mentor, Ralph Waldo Emerson. How would you describe sort of the essence of transcendentalism?
You have to start by putting it in a religious framework, which works very well in this moment, early 19th century in America, where you've got liberal ministers arguing for religious faith in a modern world. And the founding voice of transcendentalism insists that each person has what he calls a likeness to God within us. And he'll extend it to say that this divine principle, you can see it in a leaf, you can see it in a creature. We're all creatures of God. We all have this divine principle. But the human being is the one who has the ability to fully cultivate all the latent capacities within and flourish in the world.
When you say that, it sounds so contemporary. You know,
it does.
To use a phrase that's popular these days, spiritual but not religious, people who don't go to church but are still deeply spiritual. I mean, it sounds like exactly what you just described.
This is when it starts. Emerson was a minister who leaves the church to become a kind of secular prophet for a modern America. Thoreau becomes first his disciple and grows up to become a rival, and Thoreau refuses to go to church. Now, his family's very religious. They do go to church, and they're very critical of their son who does not. But that was exactly the crisis that he faced. He felt that churches were not responding to this deeper inner truth. Churches of the time in his town, for instance, would not condone discussion of slavery or anti-slavery issues, and he felt that was wrong. So he and actually his older sister both refused to enter a church.
Now, you said that Thoreau had been a disciple of Ralph Waldo Emerson, then became his rival. We have to talk about this. I mean, sort of this fascinating story. So Emerson was this towering intellectual figure at the time and lived in the same town. Thoreau lived in his house for a long time. In fact, he kind of looked after Emerson's children for a while. Emerson was his benefactor. He wants to please Emerson. Emerson thinks he's the great student.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, he returns after graduating to his hometown. And in the meantime, here's the son of Concord, born and grew up there, and somebody new has moved into town just down the street. And who is it but this absolutely gigantic intellectual figure, Ralph Waldo Emerson, whose work he's been reading, and there he is down the street. And of course, Thoreau wants very much to be admitted into this elite intellectual circle that's gathering around Emerson. But he's the son of a pencil maker and doesn't want to enter as a kind of charity case. He wants to enter as an equal. So he tries to catch Emerson's attention by writing a poem, a very stylish poem that will turn Emerson's head. And that works. And eventually Emerson opens the circle to him when he says Thoreau should come hear him lecture in Boston. Thoreau walks into Boston, 17 miles, to hear Emerson lecture. And so from then on, Thoreau is right at the heart of the family circle and becomes Emerson's associate, apprentice, yes, handyman.
And it's worth pointing out that the land on Walden Pond, where Thoreau went to live for 2 years, was Emerson's land.
Right. Emerson bought that. The railroad came through, railroad speculators. He came upon a group of railroad speculators as they were about to purchase that land and develop it. Emerson bought it on the spot and gave Henry permission to build his long dreamed of cabin on the pond. So, of course, Thoreau's goal is not to sound like Emerson, not to be an imitator. It's kind of like that land on Walden Pond. Emerson creates the conditions for originality, but then Thoreau has to build his own house on it. And having built this physical house, he's building his intellectual house, discovering his own voice as a writer. And that means breaking away from Emerson. So there's a real long period of tension. It's almost, gosh, if I added it up, at least a decade.
So what did that mean to break away? I mean, did he reject some of Emerson's ideas? Was this a philosophical difference or a difference in temperament?
It's partly a difference in temperament. Thoreau was very passionate, very empathetic, and Emerson had a kind of cool personality, tended to put people at a distance. Many people experience this with Emerson, but it drives Thoreau crazy. So he develops a very crusty oppositional stance to Emerson. And the two, they love it. They get along together because they're always arguing. They're always getting each other's goat, right? And this sense of kind of one-upping each other. For a while, it becomes tense because Emerson becomes very famous. And Emerson is a towering global figure. Thoreau is literally living in his shadow and wants to find his own voice. And finding his way to Walden Pond, as I say, building the house becomes a gesture of building his intellectual house and breaking away.
And to some degree, I mean, my sense is that Thoreau lived out some of the ideas that Emerson talked about.
Even Emerson agrees that Thoreau lived out some of his own best ideas. The difference between them is Thoreau is in love with the physical world. He's a sensual person who thinks nothing of stripping himself naked and walking into a stream, shocking everybody as he walks downstream naked because he wants to feel the water on his flesh. And that sense of physicality, of literally just loving immersion in the world and making that a condition of his writing. So how can you convey that in print? How can you write to load your text with all the squishy, muddy, hot, lively details of the world? And Thoreau wants to attune himself so exactly to the physical world that this becomes the inspiration for his scientific quest. So he becomes a proto-ecologist, as we would say today.
Mm-hmm. You say at one point in your biography that Thoreau's 2 years and 2 months at Walden Pond was an iconic work of performance art.
Yes.
What did you mean?
So he builds the house. The moment he starts cutting trees down on the shore of Walden Pond, people start coming by because he's right by the main road.
Right. So he's not isolated, living in solitude out in the wilderness. I mean, he's just right on the edge of town.
It is shockingly close to being right on the edge of town and right there where people can see him. So one of the things I argue is that he's more conspicuous now than he ever was when he was just another guy on the sidewalks of Concord. Everybody can see him, and they walk up to him, and they say, "Henry, what are you doing?" And he tells them. And the moment that that starts, which is the moment he starts to swing an axe, he discovers that he has to find a way to communicate answers to these questions. They're real questions, and he isn't sure of the answers himself.
You say no American writer is more place-centered than Henry Thoreau. How so?
He thought, as any aspiring writer might think, that he could detach himself from his home environment and go somewhere else to practice his craft. So he goes to New York, tries to break into the New York literary market, and it's a disaster on so many levels. For one thing, nobody in New York is buying writing from an unknown author. And so he starts to long to return, is desperately homesick. And the instant he gets back home, he's out and it's winter and he's chasing a fox and loving it, feeling I am where I am supposed to be. And through the years, you watch the kind of writing that he does. He takes a little notebook with him wherever he goes, and he's always taking the pencils that he made with him, making little notes on these pieces of paper that he then takes and writes up in his journal, and the journal becomes a foundation for all the great literary works that are still read today. That immersion of writing as you see, as you experience, everything that he touched with his eyes or with his hands, with his body, became part of his mind. And so in the later years, he walks out into the landscape and it's all a part of him. And people who know the landscape said, it's Henry himself spread all around us. We take walks in the woods and Henry is everywhere.
That was Steve Paulson talking with Laura Dassow Walls. Her book is Henry David Thoreau, A Life. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about the wisdom of trails. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about walking outdoors and finding solace in nature. And we're on one of my favorite paths. So last week when I came down here, I hadn't been here for a while. And last week when I came down, there's this new thing. Somebody's built a boardwalk. The lovely thing about a trail, a path, is you just walk. You just get on it and you walk. And it's easy to think of all the rest as somehow something you shouldn't set foot in. You just stay on the trail. Stay on the trail. It's what the signs say in all the national parks, right? You can think about our life that way. So often we think, stay on the trail. Just stay on the path, whatever the path of your life is. Tempting to step off into the wilderness. I learned a lot about trails from Robert Moore, who wrote a wonderful book called On Trails, An Exploration. He was through hiking the Appalachian Trail when he started wondering about the paths that he was following, like who built them, why some of them lasted and some of them didn't. And he wound up exploring trails all over the world and thinking about their deeper meanings.
We think of hiking as an aesthetic experience, and we often think of it in terms of vistas and landscapes. And so when you don't have it, it feels odd. You think, what's the point? Why am I walking if I can't see a view? The moment you really start thinking about it is when the trail goes wrong. It's when something a little bit illogical would happen that you would get intensely frustrated and you would think, who built this? And
what
why?
Do you mean?
Why
what?
Did they put this here? A hiking trail is designed to be sustainable. So it has to shed water in certain ways. It has to avoid certain places. So it will sometimes go a place where you as a hiker don't want to go, but the trail builder needs you to go there. And hikers get very, very frustrated by this because hikers, especially through hikers, want to get where they want to go as quickly as possible. They want to follow the path of least resistance. And so that's one of the interesting things about the task of building hiking trails is that you have to convince people to go where they don't necessarily want to go. And oftentimes hikers won't do it. They'll take a shortcut. And they'll create what are called desire lines, which cut across the trail.
I love that term, desire lines. That was the point when you first brought it up in the book where I thought, oh, that's such a beautiful metaphor. It made me wonder, you know, what's the desire line in my life? And am I following it?
Yeah, it's true. It has a really strong metaphorical resonance for people because we are born into the world, I think, with various paths laid out for us. And one of the questions is, it's really the deep question of wisdom, is do you follow these paths that are laid out for you, or do you start making your own path? And then one of the things I love about the metaphor of the trail is that it is so applicable, because most people have walked on trails. Everybody has walked on some kind of trail, whether it's in an urban environment or in the woods. So you know instinctively it's much easier to walk on a trail, right? It's much harder to strike off into the weeds and the brambles. And so that is something that I thought about constantly while I was hiking the Appalachian Trail, is by following this path that was laid out for me, am I missing something? Or is this actually the best path from Georgia to Maine?
Well, that's interesting, because in our culture, I think we tend to glorify the trail blazers rather than the trail followers. As you explored the metaphor, did you come to think differently?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's a very American way of thinking, right? And if you go back and you read, for example, Thoreau is appalled by the idea of following a trail. He believes everyone should be a trailblazer in life. And of course, Emerson writing about self-reliance, there's a long tradition in America of believing that following a trail is kind of shameful. It's kind of cowardly. But actually, when you look into it, following a trail is also a very original act, because every person who follows the trail edits the trail a little bit as they're following it. That's what I find so beautiful about them. It's such a beautiful idea that we are, as a collective body, we are creating this thing together, which takes us all where we need to go.
You did so much research. What are the most complex trails you uncovered?
Probably ant trails. Because they're made of pheromones, they're not impressed into the earth. They evaporate very quickly, which means that they can change very quickly. And what that allows ants to do is to create these networks of incredible efficiency, so they can solve problems that we even have trouble solving. And people will actually study ants to learn how to better route packages through a shipping network, or how to better route information through the internet.
Really?
It's true. It's amazing, because they're very simple animals, and yet collectively they're incredibly smart. And in a certain sense, that collective intelligence resides in their trails. It's the very structure and makeup of their trails that makes them so smart.
What's so amazing about their trails?
Well, for example, fire ants, which E.O. Wilson has famously studied, they can tell each other not just where food is, but how much food is there by the strength of their trail. And then as the food begins to diminish, the trail will begin to dissipate as well. So you have this ever-updating map of where all the food is, and it's mesmerizing, because you think, how could they have, with no central coordination, they're managing to do all of this? It's incredible.
Elephants turn out to be amazing virtuoso trail makers.
Yeah, incredible. Probably unparalleled because of their size and their intelligence and the incredible power of their sensory organs. They will find paths that we end up building into our roads and our highways. I remember hiking in Tanzania years ago and following elephant trails and just marveling at them, thinking, how do they always find the shallowest crossing across a river? How do they always find the lowest pass through the mountains? You imagine them almost having a kind of telepathy or a God's eye view of the landscape.
They also seem to sort of have evolved to walk trails. Their feet are incredibly light.
They're incredibly soft. They're incredibly sensitive, to the point that their feet are almost like stethoscopes. They can actually feel vibrations through the ground and sense rainstorms many, many miles away. There's a little anecdote. Three rangers who were sleeping had accidentally laid down a tarp in the middle of an elephant trail and woke up in the morning and realized that there was an elephant footprint in between where they were lying down. An elephant had actually walked right over them, and they hadn't even known it, because that's how quiet they are.
Wow. Have you ever been in a pathless wilderness, tried hiking without a trail?
I have, yeah. I've quite a few times I found myself for certain stretches, but by far the most memorable was in Newfoundland, a place called the North Rim Traverse around Western Brook Pond, which is designated as a pathless wilderness. They will never build a trail there. And you actually have to pass a navigation test before you can go in. It's a little bit daunting. You have to pass this map and compass test, and then they give you a little tracking device which will locate your hopefully still living body if you stop moving. And I went there by myself. I had no cell phone. I had no GPS, just a map and compass. I really wanted to test myself. And it was, to be honest, it was kind of horrifying. I felt very, very uneasy from the first moment I started out because I realized how accustomed I had become to following a trail. And there were these trees called tuckamore, which are elfinwood trees. They're very short and very sturdy. They can be 100 years old and only reach as high as your waist because the wind has stunted their growth. So you had to fight your way through these trees. And for 3 days, I just fought and fought my way across this landscape. I got completely lost. I was miles off track. And then on the last day, I found my way back to the trail. There was a big cairn, a big stone cairn marking where the trail was. And I felt this flood of relief just to be back on a trail. And that was, I think, when I really realized the value of a trail.
Robert Moore is the author of On Trails. We talked together about walking. Okay, let's keep going. While we're often looking down when we're walking along a trail, sometimes you need to look up, too, to the sky. Nate Staniforth has an idea for us.
My name's Nate Staniforth. I'm a magician and the author of Here Is Real Magic. My dangerous idea requires just a little bit of context. The short version is that you should set your alarm and stay up tonight, go outside, and watch the night sky. You should just lose yourself in it. Let me explain why I think this is important. If you are anything like me, it's very easy to get lost in the day-to-day business of living. I have seen the stars and seen the night sky so many times that it's so easy to just ignore it and take it for granted. But recently, I walked outside to take the trash can, put it by the street for the truck to take it away in the morning. And for some reason, I stopped and just stood there and looked up at the sky, and it just knocked me down. It had been a long time since I've ever done that deliberately. And it just stretched up forever, and immediately all of the things that I was worried about, I was no longer worried about them. It's like time stood still for a second. It resonated with me so clearly and so powerfully because that's what a magician's trying to do, right? A magician is trying to take an audience and pull them away from the world for a moment and to give them this moment of genuine awe and wonder. If I can do that with a card trick, that's great. If I can do it with a mind-reading illusion, that's great. But if I can do it just by encouraging someone to stop at 9:30 this evening and go outside and look at the sky, I have never looked at it deliberately and not been astonished by it. And so that's my idea. That's my recommendation. It sounds like a cliche until you try it, and then it just takes over everything for a few minutes.
That was the magician Nate Staniforth, author of Here Is Real Magic. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
part of the experience of walking is stopping. To let the senses connect with the sounds, the smells, the colors of the natural world. Adults often have to remind themselves to do this, but it comes pretty naturally to kids. And those early moments of wonder can be formative experiences.
When I was maybe 12, I was totally in love with amphibians, and in the rural area north of Hamburg, those ponds, which are now long gone, they have been rationalized away, but there were these little ponds in the landscape, and I spent days, maybe even weeks, alone traveling to these ponds and just looking if I'd find some beautiful unknown amphibians. And I remember when I, for the first time, didn't only see frogs and toads, but I found a newt. It was late winter, so it was maybe March or something. It was kind of cold, and I remember lying on my belly, and I couldn't believe the treasure I found. And I was watching this animal hanging in the water. They come up and gasp for air, and then they just slowly sink down. And I was transfixing this animal, this newt. It stared into me and through me and drew me in, and I found myself in this other body and found my ecstasy in this simple, relaxed, generous, just being there. I knew that somehow this was the hinge of the universe at that moment. It was just revolving around this connection between two beings who are one being in the end.
Andreas Weber grew up to become a biologist and a philosopher. He lives in Berlin, and when Steve Paulson was there, they went for a walk.
Where are we right now?
We are in the Grunewald forest, which is a huge forest inside the city of Berlin, about maybe 15 kilometers. So I go here when I need closer contact to the more than human world. Sorry.
Oh, it's all right.
Morgan.
That phone call is a reminder that even when we're in the middle of this forest, civilization is close by. And that's what Andreas is here to remind me. There's no clean line between what's human and what's nature. Andreas Weber is a biologist and philosopher with a very unconventional way of describing the natural world. In fact, he's the first scientist I've ever met who talks about love as a basic principle of biology. It's part of what he calls an erotic ecology. And this very sensory, hands-on understanding of the world, his biology of wonder, has won Andreas admirers around the world. And it brought me here today, deep in the Grunewald forest, with his little poodle Absa trotting along beside us on a mission to find a tiny oak tree.
Hören wir uns dann gleich. Gut, ciao. I brought some water because I need to try to bring back to life our little baby oak. Can you see the little stem coming out without any leaves?
Uh-huh.
It's actually a sad story. My wife gave that to me 2 years ago for my birthday, and we planted it together. If you get an oak for a birthday, you need to plant it in a forest. And for some reason, during our absence in the last months, somebody or something broke it. So doesn't have any leaves anymore and looks a little bit sad. But it's still green under the bark, so I'm giving water to it. It will take some time.
Yeah, because, no, that's totally
because
fine.
The soil is so dry that the water doesn't sink in rapidly. So you'll see this.
Okay, that's fine.
I mean, it's a sort of
It's a sort of meditation way.
As Andreas sits down in the dirt to water his tree, he tells me something I never would have guessed. His baby oak was almost certainly eaten by wild boars.
Wait, there are wild boars in this park here?
Yeah. They're wild boars.
So we might see one today?
Yeah, but it's... They are there, maybe like 150 meters there behind you in the forest. And they even come out of the forest into the streets. And they're in the gardens.
Are there any violent interactions between boars and people?
No, they're basically peaceful. But sometimes they're impressive. And... when I started my relationship with my now wife, often instead of going out and hanging out in bars or whatever, we went to the forest and we put out our picnic blanket and had a glass of wine. And then the white boars came and the dog sat there, very anxious, the little poodle. No, but they're around and it's a kind of coexistence. And I mean, if we met one, he or she would stare at us from a 20 meters distance and then probably grunt and run off.
Well, in some ways that gives it extra meaning. Nature is not just out there, it's where we live.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you come out here, you want to commune with the more than human world. And so, from a biologist's perspective, what might you be noticing that I don't notice as someone who doesn't have your kind of background?
Yeah. I think the first thing is you are already noticing it because it's a question of just being here and sinking in the surroundings. So you feel the wind stirring these birches at the fringe of the forest and the pines a little bit behind. And maybe you saw these two crows playing in the bigger pine a little bit. Can you hear the wind now starting to slightly making the birch leaves rustle?
Yeah.
It's like meeting a spirit through its body in a way and being greeted in some way or another because it touches you when it floats around my hair and touches my skin. So it's a communion in a way.
Does the wind feel alive to you?
Absolutely, absolutely. Particularly today, it has a very delicate and interesting character right now. Now it feels alive and as a movement in the atmosphere which comprises us all and which makes all the bodies somehow stir and which is the chamber of exchange between my body and the body of the plant. What I exhale is what they eat, and what they breathe out is what I need to breathe in to exist. So it's truly the shared substance of our bodies. Oh, do you feel the wind coming in right now? And can you see that the sky is a little bit darker behind the trees? And so there's this gust of wind now coming. I can't help to feel that I'm deeply communicating with all these other bodies, which are then in a way parts of a larger body of which my body is, again, a part.
One thing that I find so striking about how you describe all of this is it's so sensory. It's obviously partly what you're looking at, but it's also what it feels like. We haven't even talked about how it smells, but it's kind of this whole body response to the environment that we're in.
It is. It is a totally sensual experience. And what you're experiencing is a kind of embodied argument for why I'm calling the whole field of interacting bodies erotic ecology, because it's mediated by your own body, which longs for continuation and for contact with other bodies, which isn't to be confused with sex or something. This is, well, let me see, where's the flower is already gone. This is some St. John's wort, which is very modest, but you always find it here.
When you say there's this drive to have contact with other beings, do you mean this in a biological sense, in a metaphorical sense?
I mean it in all possible senses, which are all linked together. So clearly there is a biological need to be contact with other beings, and not only in contact, but in intimate exchange as we breathe in what they breathe out, and we actually eat them, and they eat us. So that's a huge metabolism in one huge flesh, in a way. So on that level, we can't avoid contact, and we don't want to avoid it because it's so beautiful. Do you hear the wind, which is now even slightly changing direction? Now it's coming from behind your back, in a way. And do you also see that the light with these typically northern German clouds is completely dramatically changing when there's a cloud covering the sun or just sailing by the sun? It's a pretty interesting day today that you came here, so good.
But most scientists would say, okay, these are mechanical processes. Wind is sort of molecules interacting in a certain way in the air. You're taking this to a whole different level.
Yeah, but I mean, they would be right because there surely are mechanical phenomena. But what you say reminds me of a colleague when I was on a seminar on a German North Sea island some years ago. And part of that seminar was a spectacular evening walk when the sun was setting in the west in this flaming red sky with dark clouds. It was really a beautiful North Sea evening. And I had breakfast with that colleague the next morning, and he told me, that was so beautiful. But you know, as a scientist, it just can't be. I don't have any explanation, so it's just nothing. It's just completely neutral. And that's actually bothering me slightly. And I said to him, no, you know, that science goes wrong there. So it's a very dangerous idea to think we are minds, or we have minds, and the remainder of the world is just stuff. It's just exactly bringing us where we are, to burning Amazon and burning Arctic and all this predicament we're in at the moment. But that's the mechanical takeover of the phenomenon of life. It's so important that it's not like you learn in school. Children learn in school, at least in many schools in Germany. They learn that you're a machine fueled by food, like you have an exhaust and out goes the burned fuel. And it's not true.
You're really saying we need a revolution in biology.
Yes.
I mean, sort of the Darwinian view, or maybe it's a certain interpretation of Darwin, that it's all about competition. That just doesn't cut it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's the basic performance of all of us, is not to function mechanically and compete, but to create ourselves from something which flows through us all the time. And this creation can only be done in communion with others. That's the kind of magical and enigmatic thing about biology. So you need others which can breathe your breath and give you back something in order to create yourself from this matter which flows through you. So this gives a totally different picture from a picture in which tiny machines are competing for resources. Beautiful, the wind, isn't it? That was also interesting. That was a raven. There it goes. It's beautiful. It's nice. Can you sit there? Could also sit on this if you want to.
I'm good here.
Just get your...
Yep.
your clothing a little bit dirty. That's erotic ecology.
There's one other word that I do want to make sure we talk about, and that's love.
Yeah.
Because that figures prominently in your ecology. And again, I don't think this is just a metaphorical idea for you. I mean, how far can we take the idea of love into an ecological understanding?
Yeah. I think we need to take it very far into it. And at the same time, we need to carefully understand what love means. I'm going so far to say that ecosystems are love processes. We see a beautiful productivity, and that's a manifestation of a love process to my eyes. And I'd say that if we go here and feel good, then love is happening. And actually, we are kind of required to reciprocate. So we can't just go here. We shouldn't just go here and take and then go back. So that's one of the reasons I took over the obligation to water some of the plants when they are suffering, to give me the feeling that I'm not only taking something beautiful, but I'm also nourishing something beautiful. That, again, is part of this love relationship.
One final question. For our listeners who are inspired by what you've been saying and want some kind of takeaway for their day-to-day life, I mean, how can they experience, have these kinds of connections with the natural world?
Yeah, we don't need expertise to do this, and we don't need a nature preserve to do this. But on a more concrete level, I'd say go and sit with a plant and just be there. Even if it might feel weird at the beginning, continue doing this, and it will start to feel really good and resourceful after a while. It's a sort of exercise which is called a sit spot. And you can do it everywhere. I mean, even in the middle of a city, you'll find some places where you can be with the wind which brushes through the leaves. To many, this might feel unfamiliar and even disturbing because you're losing time. Sitting 10 minutes there, it's like losing 10 minutes of your day. But on the other hand, you're gaining time because then you have 10 minutes in which you can be in what you always already are, namely a relationship of mutuality with the remainder of the world.
That was Steve Paulson talking with eco-philosopher Andreas Weber, the author of several books including The Biology of Wonder and Matter and Desire, An Erotic Ecology. And that's it for this hour. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced from Madison, Wisconsin at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Shannon Henry Kleiber. Charles Monroe Kane, Angelo Bautista, and Mark Rickers helped. Our technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. And if you would like to get a behind-the-scenes look at our show and producers, make sure to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. You'll find it at ttbook.org/newsletter. Thanks for wandering through these paths with us today.